Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
She was a sweetheart. We'd take her outside, and we have geese in the backyard and ducks. We've had them since, well, they've just reproduced from 1946 on up to present day. We've kept them going. And the first word that was said and she learned was duck, because we got ducks out there, and bird. So she knew duck and bird. Just run around the back lawn, and she'd point a lot at the birds and at the geese and the ducks, and she'd just play, and she was just a playful little girl. I mean, she was 19 months old, and at that time, that's about what they did, and I just watched her grow up.
On May 25th, 2003, just days before she would have turned 19 months old, Acacia Bishop was at her great-grandmother's house in Salt Lake City, Utah. Acacia's great-grandmother was babysitting her while her parents attended a wedding rehearsal. Throughout the day, Acacia was helping her great-grandmother Linda clean and vacuum in the kitchen, one of her favorite things to do. Acacia's grandmother Kelly Jean Laudmill was also at the house that day. At around 6 p.m., Kelly took Acacia from the home when her great-grandmother Linda left the room, kidnapping the toddler. This was not the first time that Kelly had taken Acacia without permission. She had once taken her and hid her from her parents in the basement apartment where Kelly had been staying. Kelly and Acacia's mother Casey had a very strained mother-daughter relationship due to Kelly's history of drug abuse, her mental health struggles due to her diagnosis of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, and her violent tendencies. Kelly was frequently unable to afford her medications, and often struggled with the vicious cycle of balancing her mood and thoughts, and then abruptly not being able to do so. On this day in May, when Acacia was abducted, Kelly took Acacia to Idaho Falls, Idaho. The next day, Kelly and Acacia were seen together. They were spotted by an overpass that crosses the Snake River. They were on the riverbank, dangling their feet in the water. The events that occurred next can only be speculated. Some believe that Kelly intentionally jumped into the river with her young granddaughter in a murder-suicide attempt, while others believe it was an elaborate ruse. Kelly was then seen by nearby plant workers soaking wet, and she told them that her granddaughter was in the river. Divers searched the whole area, but there was no sign of Acacia. The only evidence that was located was Acacia's doll and a pair of baby shoes that were found on the riverbank. Officials believe that Acacia drowned in the Snake River that day. However, some family members believe that Acacia could have either been given to someone else to be raised, or could have been sold into a trafficking ring. Over the years, many theories have come forward about the abduction and possible murder of Acacia Bishop. But to this day, Acacia's fate remains unknown. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 223 of The Vanished, Acacia Bishop's story. Everyone knows that finding the perfect t-shirt can be a challenge. I've always had problems whether it was with the fit or quality. Luckily, the perfect t-shirt does exist, and you can find it at Skims. From cropped silhouettes to long-sleeve layering tees, there's a style for everyone. You know that I've been wearing Skims for a long time, and recently tried one of their t-shirts. It's the best-fitting tee I've ever worn. Skims makes the best basics and foundations. I got the boyfriend t-shirt in Onyx, and it's so soft and comfortable. I want to wear it every day. It literally fits like a dream. Shop the Skims t-shirt shop at skims.com, now available in sizes extra extra small to 4X. If you haven't yet, be sure to let them know I sent you. After you place your order, select podcast in the survey and select my show in the drop-down menu that follows. Adam and Casey Bishop were over the moon when they had their daughter, Asacia. She, just like any child in the eyes of her parents, was perfect. On a personal note, Casey had a strained relationship with her mother, Kelly. Truth be told, she wanted little to nothing to do with her. However, Adam pushed Casey to try and make amends with her mother, more so for the sake of their daughter. So Casey tried. Kelly, a woman who lived with severe mental illness, faced many struggles within her own life. Delusions of grandeur and many bouts of violent tendencies, one of which included an aggravated assault against a police officer, just months before Asacia was abducted. Casey and Adam allowed Kelly to see her granddaughter. On one particular occasion, Kelly took Asacia from her parents without their permission. The pair were missing for about a half hour before they were found. Kelly seemed to want to take Asacia as her own. Her behavior was not the norm for a grandmother. Trust had been broken after this situation in an already fractured relationship, but Adam and Casey continued to allow Kelly to see Asacia, but only during strict supervised visitation. May 25th, 2003 was one of those visits. Asacia was at her great-grandparents' home while her parents attended a wedding rehearsal. Kelly waited until Linda, her mother, left the room for a brief moment when she took the opportunity to kidnap Asacia. For this story, we were able to speak with Asacia's father, Adam. Here is Adam speaking about his daughter.
We called her Asacia. She was Casey and my first child that we had in October 29th. She was a really lively little girl and really smart, and she had a birthmark on her stomach that was about the size of a tennis ball. She had blonde hair and blue eyes and just a really active little toddler, basically.
It's quite obvious that the relationship between Asacia's mom, Casey, and her mother, Kelly, was strained long before Asacia disappeared. While we were speaking with Adam, we asked him if he could tell us more about his mother-in-law, Kelly, in the time leading up to her kidnapping Asacia.
Well, Kelly Laudmill, the grandmother who was the perpetrator, she had been dealing, from what I understand, with a psychosis and bouts of psychopathy. She had previously tried to take our daughter the previous November, where she hid her away from Casey and I when we had her babysitting, and threatening us that we weren't going to see her again. And eventually she came forward with her when we had threatened to leave and call the police from her apartment, and we were able to get to her. And then that's when we had told her that she would never, we wouldn't let her see her again because of her actions. So then we had our daughter being watched by Casey's grandmother, Linda, and we were going to a wedding rehearsal. And that's when Kelly arrived at the grandma's house and waited for the opportune moment to snatch Asacia away from Linda when her back was turned, from what I understand. Kelly would show that she cared about Asacia and, you know, want to hang out with her and play with her when we would have her around. But after the initial time in November, from what I understood, there was a new law or something that was written or accepted that made it harder for her to get her medicine that would keep her psychosis down. And so she couldn't access that medicine anymore, which then propagated to her instability. From what I could see, Kelly was excited to see Asacia when we would bring her over. And she would, you know, want to play with her and give her toys. And she brought her, when she was born, got her clothes. And she seemed to be excited, but with what happened, it tends to make you believe that she was bringing our guard down. But I don't know. I really don't know. Casey had told me that she did not want to have a relationship with her mom just because of her mom's instability and her mom's issues with drugs. And, you know, Casey, being an only child, she kind of felt like her mother was someone who wanted to rule with an iron fist and wouldn't let anybody around her, and would always try to run every person out of Casey's life. But when we had Asacia, because of my relationship with my parents and my mom, I had pressed Casey for her to, you know, forgive her mom of any wrongdoing and try to have a better relationship with her. And in hindsight, it was probably the wrong thing to do.
We were also able to speak with Linda, Asacia's great-grandmother and Kelly's mother. She told us more about the events leading up to and after Asacia's abduction. Here's Linda.
Her and I'd go outside, and she'd be with her grandpa. She loved her grandpa. She'd sit on his lap, and he'd walk her out the driveway, and we'd walk her down the driveway, and I'd pick her up, of course, and walk her out in the backyard, and we taught her to walk out here, and she was in everything, and she'd get into things on the fireplace, and we'd have to teach her, no, we don't do that. And she pointed a lot. She used that little finger to point at everything. Very inquisitive. She'd like to pick up the hose when we had it going on the lawn. She'd take it and pick it up. She watched Grandma work. At times when I was vacuuming in the kitchen, I'd put her in front of me and pretend that she was vacuuming the floor while I pushed it. She thought that was okay, because I say she was doing such a great job cleaning Grandma's house. And the day that the abduction was done, I went to put the vacuum away back in the hall and came back out, and she was gone. Kelly had taken her. Kelly was cleaning things behind the house, moving furniture and things behind the house. And then she'd come in to get a drink of water, and then she'd go back out and work. There was a man friend that she had out there that was helping her, and he was here, and they were cleaning, and then she'd come back in, and Kelly had seen me cleaning, and Stacy was walking around with a little doll that I had given her. I went, well, I was done vacuuming, and I put the vacuum away, and Kelly just came in, took the baby, left the guy, and took her and left. No idea, no nothing, until I came out, and I come in and asked my husband, I says, have you seen Kelly? I mean, have you seen the baby? And he said, no. I says, well, Kelly's taken her. And that's when everything started happening. At that time, we called the police, and we were the second people in Salt Lake to get the Amber Alert going. And then they stopped it. We have no idea why they called the Amber Alert off. Now, if they would have kept that Amber Alert going like they should have, they may have caught her or recognized maybe even the car or something on the freeway. But then they called it on at 10 o'clock, and that was way too late, because by that time she was in Idaho. Well, anyway, we looked all over town. I got in my car and went looking to places where I thought that the baby might be, or had taken, or Kelly might be, and nobody had seen her. So her intent was just to get her fast and leave town. And no one had any idea that she'd, you know, go to Idaho.
We asked Linda how often Kelly was at her home. We were curious if it was a frequent or infrequent occurrence.
She didn't spend that much time over here, just to come over, wash, and shower. She was homeless. Kelly had taken Casey and hid her in an apartment below where Kelly was staying. And she told Casey that it was Stacy was her baby, and she's not getting her. They started looking all over for Asacia. Then finally they went downstairs where Kelly had hit her, in where there was some man that was renting the apartment below her, and there Stacy was. Kelly had hit her down with this guy below her in another apartment in the same building. She didn't like being around people at all. I know when we lived in Montana, if anybody was visiting us, Kelly would go right by our house. She would never come in.
Linda told us more about Casey and Kelly's strained relationship, as well as Kelly's drug abuse.
As far as drugs, Casey told me that she thought that she was using like cocaine or something in Great Falls, but I never seen her. Casey may have seen her. When she got here in Salt Lake, I knew she was using something, and I know it was meth because her skin started to break out, and I was so afraid of what was happening to her. But when she was working on we were painting a house in Great Falls, and Kelly, we had what they call a DA-er, where it's like a sander. She took all the lead paint off the house because we were repainting it, and she got lead poisoning. And we think that that had something to do with something. Casey didn't like her mother, but Kelly forced herself upon Casey by wanting to kiss her all the time. But Casey didn't want no part of her mother because Kelly was so forceful and wanted to hug her and love her, but Casey didn't want no part of it. And I don't know why. She trusted me, but she didn't trust her mom. She did a little bit. After the time that Kelly went and hid the baby, that took care of anything, any progress that may have or might have started, that destroyed it when she hid that baby. And that's basically what happened. And Casey told her, you're never going to see her again. And that could have prompted Kelly to take her. If she had a chance, she's going to take her. And Kelly did.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this, and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. What happened between the time that Kelly took Asacia on May 25th and the next day is somewhat of a mystery. What we do know is that Kelly and Asacia made their way from Salt Lake City, Utah, to Idaho Falls, Idaho, which is only about a 3-hour drive. On the evening of the 25th, Kelly checked into a motel in Idaho Falls with Asacia. The hotel clerk noted nothing seemed amiss. The following day is when they were spotted near an overpass by the river. Later, Kelly, soaking wet, ran to a hydroelectric plant nearby and told them that her granddaughter was in the water. The plant workers made the decision to shut down the plant due to the fear that Acacia could be sucked into their turbines. Due to some of the theories surrounding this case, we asked Adam if there was any type of physical evidence besides eyewitness accounts that placed Kelly and Acacia together on May 26th.
There was video initially of Kelly standing wrapped in a blanket pointing at the river that was broadcast on local networks that I had since tried to find because it's self-incriminating. And that video disappeared, so I could never find that. But and there was a witness. He had said that he saw Kelly on the riverbank with our daughter, Danny Rutledge. We could never find him. He just fell off the face of the earth. And we tried. I mean, we looked for 2 years. I sold my house. I sold almost every possession we had in order to stay up to where the last place that she was saw. And all these leads would just fade in the wind. And there was no, you know, we could never find her. And it was just something that we had to just leave. And we couldn't stay in that place.
Adam told us more about the area where it is believed that Acacia entered the water and why he believes that if she had drowned there, her body would have been recovered.
That spot that she went in, it was immediately, it preceded a spillway, which was where the water dropped down because they dammed it up right there. And the spillway only led over 2 to 3 inches of water. And the baby would have hit that and stopped, and it wouldn't have pressed up over the water. And if the baby drowned and went under the water, they would have found the body because they searched that area for 2 weeks with cadaver dogs, with divers. And during the time that we stayed and searched up there, an old man fell in the river, upriver, about a half a mile up, and he was found on the grates down below. So the bodies don't go through the grate. It stops them underneath because the water continues moving. So where she went in, it was such a confined area that it's improbable that they didn't find her. And it only tends the credence to that she was handed off and this was a ruse. It pulls on me that if that's what it is, because as much as we set to search and to for nothing, for no sign, for no body, for no clothes, no, there was no sign. She literally disappeared off the face of the earth.
While many believe that Acacia drowned on May 26, 2003, Adam told us about some other possibilities that could have occurred that day.
I believe that Kelly could have been mixed up with child trafficking. And these people, when I was stomping around their back door, did not want any of this to be exposed because the I-15 corridor is a child trafficking hub. I had a hard time with the people and police in Idaho, and I got a radio show to where I would voice my complaints because I believe that the chief there in Idaho Falls and the detective that was on my case did not listen or follow through to my requests of what I wanted to do. And I was asked multiple times to leave the state. And in fact, one time I came home to many police at my door, and I was told that they were there to remove me from the city. I had an army of people. We had our own office there, and the people that donated our office space were asked from either their management or from a politician or something to not help us and to take away that office space. And I also was asked when I had my radio show through the Trish and Holly show, they had come to me and said that they were going to lose their sponsorship if they didn't take me off the radio. So there was a lot of things like that. And with Danny Rutledge disappearing off the face of the earth and he being the only witness to Kelly having my daughter by the water, all of these instances just leave me to believe that there was something bigger that people were trying to keep under wraps. And Acacia was just one of the
steps and one of the people inside of it. I mean, either she put her in the river or she handed her to somebody. And there are people that we pressed the police to find, which was there was a man of interest who checked out the room that Kelly stayed in the Red Lion Inn. And he had some cheaper cigarettes that were, you know, just a cheap brand name. And the lady who checked out that room said it was a man that checked out that room. But nobody can point and show me who this person is. And the police tell me from there that he didn't exist. But if I'm not mistaken, I think the ladies that checked out the room, her name was Holly, and we did an interview. And I went and paid and got an artist to get an artist's depiction of what this person looked like. And I put that out there into the news. And the police told me to stop doing it because I felt that they lacked on their investigation skills, because multiple times when they told me they cleared an area that they investigated, namely the spot where they believe that she went in, I went through there with a fine-tooth comb and found a transient encampment that had a bunch of stuff where someone was living. And I said, well, where's this person? And they said, that doesn't even matter. And I'm like, everything matters. Every point, every person, every individual that was here, that could have been here, that could have been a possible witness, could have been a possible perpetrator. And I said, and until we rule all these out, you can't. And then the detective, Cowley, took the information and the stuff I had, and he threw it in the river. And he said, you guys have to leave. He said, all you're doing, he goes, she's gone. And the enforcement, law enforcement there in Idaho, I detested. And that's why when I was on the radio show, I told the town, I said, you guys have a law enforcement chief of police who actually was fired from another town for insubordination. I said, and he's your chief of police. And I said, and you have detectives here that don't want to follow leads, and they're just going to do what their upper ups tell them to do. And that's not right. And I said, because you guys deserve better protection and better people that serve you that don't serve themselves. And that's what these guys are doing. And that's what I felt, that was there was something that they did not like, because I felt that they didn't appreciate me stirring up stuff and getting the feds up there, because the feds came up, because I brought the FBI with them. I had an agent, Russell Johnson, that was stationed out of Salt Lake, but that was his jurisdiction. And I gave him copies of everything that I had, and I explained to him and pressed him for, you know, my concerns of how these, from the very beginning, from the very first day of us being up there, the police and the law enforcement told us that we didn't need to be there, that she was gone. And I mean, where she went in supposedly was so confined. It was so confined that 100 yards was a spillway. So it was a big grate where the water funneled through, and it was a fish safe grate. So that means that the grates down below were only an inch and a half apart, which a body would sit against that. And they dove for 2 weeks in that spot. She wasn't in the water. When I take all of the evidence into account, when I know how Kelly would almost want to protect Asacia, the night that Kelly arrived in Idaho, she went and got a room, and she came downstairs and asked the person at the desk what store was open to go get diapers. So she was concerned with the well-being of my daughter enough that she wanted to go get some diapers and spend money. So he told her that the Albertsons was open. So she went and got a package of diapers for Asacia. From what I understand, it was a good size package. So if you're planning on doing what everybody believes you did, why would you go and get a large package of diapers unless you had an extended time period that you're going to act upon? I felt that it was a ruse that what she did, and it was to misdirect. And I felt that she handed her off to somebody, because just before this incident happened, she had cashed a big check, whether it was her Social Security check or a tax check, but she had a good amount of money. with her. And when she was arrested, she did not have any money. There wasn't that package of diapers that was there. You know, there was a lot of things that should have been there that weren't, that was missing. And all everybody just told me was, well, that's just circumstantial. That really doesn't matter. But when you put them together as a whole, it points you somewhere else. Well, it seems like somebody that would do that would, they have a plan. That's a long-term kind of thing, you know, to where it just doesn't make sense. And then when that morning, when she was walking with Asacia or Hatter, there were people that saw her along the riverfront and she was playing with her, you know, and having fun. And there was more than just the Danny Rutledge. There was a jogger that seen her right there, right at the foot of the Red Lion Hotel. So where, from where the hotel was to where the place was that they said the incident happened was probably about a half a mile, maybe a little bit more. And then she had to cross the bridge with Asacia to get to the other side to where the supposed incident happened, to where this Danny Rutledge saw that she was there on the shore of the waters. But, you know, nobody saw her go in with the baby. They saw that she was wet. Kelly was wet. And she said, my baby went in, but there was no child.
While being questioned, Kelly told more than one story about what happened to Asacia. One of her stories was that this was a murder-suicide attempt. She said she held Asacia tight under the water and then let her go. Another version of the story was that they were simply playing in the water and she lost her grip on Asacia. Adam has always found it difficult to believe any of Kelly's stories. One day, while handing out flyers, a witness came forward and told Adam that months prior, when Kelly was incarcerated on unrelated charges, she had bragged to another inmate about kidnapping Asacia the first time and said that she would do it again, but this time she wouldn't get caught. Kelly was arrested and initially charged with kidnapping and murder in Idaho. But not long after, federal kidnapping charges were filed. Idaho put their charges on hold while the federal government tried Kelly. In the end, she was found not guilty by reason of insanity. She has been committed to a federal facility indefinitely. It's unlikely that Kelly will ever be released, but if she is, she can still face kidnapping and murder charges in the state of Idaho. Kelly has written her daughter Casey since she's been committed, and they aren't sure what to make of her letters.
She also wrote letters, and she, in her letters, stated that Asacia would be found later, and she would walk into a Kmart and say, hey, I'm that kidnapped kid. Now, I don't know if that was just for misdirection or for us to have a shred of hope to hold on to, but believe me, it's not anything I don't think about every day and wish that could happen, but I understand that it's almost a dream that, you know, you just kind of remember and you just have to live your life.
While working on this story, we were able to obtain some court documents from when Kelly was tried and later committed. One document that proved to be helpful in understanding Kelly's mental health issues, along with her history of violent behaviors, was her dangerousness assessment. This combined her history with evaluations from experts on both the prosecution side and the defendant side. I'm going to read some portions from this document. On January 3, 2005, the defendant was found not guilty only by reason of insanity at the time of the offense charged. The defendant shall be committed to the custody of the United States Attorney General following an evaluation and hearing. If the court finds that the defendant presents a substantial risk to persons or property, as established by a stipulation at the defendant's trial, defendant has a severe mental disease or defect. Specifically, the diagnosis of the defendant following the evaluation conducted at the U.S. Medical Center for Federal Prisons was that she has schizophrenia, undifferentiated type. The diagnosis of the defendant's expert was similar. That is, that she has psychotic disorder, probable paranoid schizophrenia. Both evaluators concluded that the mental disease or defect was so severe that the defendant was unable to appreciate the nature and quality of her acts at the time of the kidnapping. Thus, there is no question that the defendant suffers from a significant mental disease or defect. The next question is whether the defendant can establish by clear and convincing evidence that she does not present a substantial risk of bodily injury to another person or serious damage of property of another due to this mental disease or defect. Based on the following, there can be no question that the defendant cannot meet her burden of proof, that she presents this risk, and that she should be committed to the custody of the Attorney General. Following defendant's trial and the verdict of not guilty only by reason of insanity, examiners were ordered to evaluate the defendant's current risk to persons and property. The evaluation followed a competency evaluation completed August 20, 2003. The defendant could understand the nature of the charges and assist counsel in her defense, and was thus competent to stand trial. It also followed a second evaluation completed September 20, 2004. Because the defendant did not appreciate the nature and quality of her acts at the time of the offense due to serious mental disease or defect, she was legally insane at the time of the offense. In conducting the risk assessment, the forensic examiners considered all information from prior evaluations, including reports, documents, interviews of family members and others, psychological tests, and clinical observations. In addition, evaluators used HCR-20, which is an instrument designed to provide clinicians a guide to risk assessment based on factors that have been supported by research findings. The HCR-20 is designed to evaluate a patient's history, current clinical features, and risk factors for future maladjustment. According to Dr. Trent Evans, who authored the report, Ms. Laudmill scored 31 of possible 40 on this instrument, placing her above the 90th percentile for psychiatric patients in the research literature. As Dr. Evans stated, there are a number of serious risk factors present in defendant's situation that put her at high risk for causing bodily injury to another person or serious damage to property of another should she be released from custody. As Dr. Evans stated, the most important factor in considering risk for future violent behavior is the history of violent behavior. First and most significantly and troubling, the defendant kidnapped and then engaged in acts which either did kill or would have been likely to kill her 18-month-old granddaughter. As indicated in the statement of facts, after taking the baby from Salt Lake City to Idaho Falls, she stayed the night in a hotel. She then decided to go to the river to make her granddaughter her angel. Shannon Thomas observed the defendant and the baby sitting on the bank of the Snake River with their feet dangling in the river. The next person to see the defendant was Kelly Shaw at the Idaho Falls power plant. The defendant walked in the back door, which is a short distance from the river. She was soaking wet and she told Shaw that her granddaughter was in the river. A short time later, Idaho Falls police located a pair of small children's shoes, a single larger shoe, a pacifier, a pair of adult socks, and a doll where the defendant had been sitting. All evidence and witness statements, including the defendant's own statements, established that the baby went into the river with the defendant, although a body was not recovered. The river exceeds 60 to 70 feet deep at places, and the location was a short distance above the hydroelectric turbines for the power plant. While the defendant initially said that she wanted to make her granddaughter an angel, she now harbors a delusion that the baby somehow made it out of the treacherous river and is alive and well. She has also failed to accept responsibility for or acknowledge the gravity of her conduct, which dramatically increases the risk she presents to society. In January 2003, the defendant was arrested on charges of aggravated assault of a police officer. The police were called to a theater because the defendant was intoxicated and carrying a knife. When the police arrived, the defendant was yelling while carrying the knife in one hand and a beer in the other. The defendant went toward the officers with the knife. In response, the officers used pepper spray. The defendant then threw the knife at the officer, causing him to take evasive action. In September 1999, the defendant was arrested on charges of aggravated assault after shooting an 11-year-old child with a pellet gun. The defendant and a friend were shooting the gun in a vacant field near the defendant's home. The defendant said she wanted to shoot in the direction of the kids playing nearby. Her friend then left, not wanting to be involved. The defendant then shot the girl in the back of the leg. Following her arrest, she said, "Yeah, I did it, and I liked it." The defendant was also convicted of driving under the influence in 1999 in the state of Utah. According to court records, the defendant was in an accident and received injuries requiring extensive medical treatment. Although not specifically referenced in Dr. Evans' report, the defendant also had involvement with law enforcement when living in Great Falls, Montana, before moving to Utah in 1998. In 1996, the police were called when the defendant committed an assault. In 1987, the defendant was arrested for domestic violence assault. In 1988, the defendant's boyfriend was arrested for assault. However, he claimed the defendant began the argument and displayed for officers his injuries and torn clothing. In 1992, the defendant was cited for possession of drug paraphernalia. In 1994, the defendant was arrested for possession of marijuana with intent to distribute. In addition, defendant was reported to law enforcement for keeping her granddaughter without permission after being allowed to have contact with her in August 2002. This was a central precipitating event to being restricted from contact with her granddaughter at the time of the kidnapping. In addition to past violent behavior, the defendant had a history of substance abuse and has suffered from a psychotic disorder for many years. The defendant has a history of abusing alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, and methamphetamine. She also has schizophrenia, with delusions of a paranoid and grandiose nature. Her paranoid symptoms fall under the category of threat/control override symptoms. These kinds of symptoms increase the risk Ms. Laudmell will engage in dangerous behavior. Her grandiose delusions further place her at risk, as her sense of importance and having a special mission from God can be distorted to justify violent behavior in the service of something more important than an individual person's life or physical integrity. Defendant became involved in the Utah mental health system from the time she moved there in 1998, and her diagnosis of major mental illness did not arise only in connection with this proceeding. Defendant was examined in July 1998 after being taken to the emergency room due to bizarre behavior. She was admitted to the University of Utah Medical Center. Following an evaluation, she was diagnosed as having schizophrenia, paranoid type. A second psychiatric evaluation in 2001 resulted in a diagnosis of delusional disorder, a major depressive disorder. While defendant's presenting symptoms at the time were less severe, her history of bizarre thinking and behavior was documented in the report. As Dr. Evans noted in his report, the defendant has poor insight into her mental illness. In fact, she does not believe she is mentally ill. She has a history of failing to comply with treatment programs and did not comply with treatment at Carswell because she did not think she needed it. In each of her three Utah convictions prior to this offense, she failed to comply with treatment programs in the terms of probation. Defendant failed to follow treatment programs after the previous psychiatric evaluations in Utah facilities. As Dr. Evans concluded, if she were to be released to the community, she would almost certainly discontinue psychiatric treatment, leaving her vulnerable. This is a significant factor in assessing the risk she presents to others. Dr. Evans also noted the defendant's extreme instability in many areas of life. She has an unstable employment history, she is often homeless, and she has no viable family support to aid her in the community. Dr. Evans concluded that the defendant's prognosis is poor. She has suffered from psychotic mental illness for many years and has failed to comply with several psychiatric treatment efforts. She has a history of psychosocial instability, violent behavior, and multiple contacts with the legal system. Ms. Laudmell will function best in a highly structured and secure inpatient setting in which treatment is mandatory and closely monitored. It was based on this that the judge decided to commit her indefinitely. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. You aren't sleeping and you're stressed out. That's how it was for me, so I cleared out my cabinet and reset my health with CBD from CB Distillery. Their deep sleep gummies are amazing. CB Distillery's targeted formulations are made from the highest quality clean ingredients. No fluff, no fillers, just pure, effective CBD solutions designed to help support your health. In two non-clinical surveys, 81% of customers experienced more calm, 80% said CBD helped with pain after physical activity, and an impressive 90% said they slept better with CBD. If you struggle with a health concern and haven't found relief, make the change to CB Distillery. And with over 2 million customers and a solid 100% money-back guarantee, CB Distillery is a source to trust. I have a 20% discount to get you started. Visit cbdistillery.com and use code VANISHED for 20% off. That's cbdistillery.com, code VANISHED. cbdistillery.com. Due to the complex nature of this story, we spoke to a psychologist, Dr. Philip Taft, regarding Kelly's mental state and her being labeled as dangerous. You may remember Dr. Taft from Serenity Denard's episode a few months ago. We believe the knowledge provided by such a professional is imperative to try to understand the sequence of events in such a complicated case. Before speaking to Dr. Taft, we sent him the court documents from Kelly's trial so that he could review them. During our conversation with Dr. Taft, he explained that not only did the government expert determine that Kelly was dangerous, but also the expert hired by the defense attorney agreed with the findings after their own evaluation.
This is so uniquely mental health, and it's somewhat rare. You know, the insanity defense is rare because most people don't have any legal knowledge about it. Secondly, it's lost most of the time in jury trials because juries don't believe it. They don't believe that somebody could not know the difference between right and wrong due to a mental illness. And so even when you try to sell it to a jury, it's hard to win. So it is the government expert who evaluated her for dangerousness, which, as we know, led to her being committed to Carswell. But also we know that the defense, her attorney, hired his own expert, and that expert agreed separately with the government findings of the government's expert. So they both said she's dangerous.
In Kelly's case, she was acquitted of the charges against her. We asked Dr. Taft to explain that further.
Acquitted simply means she is not guilty, right? And so she was acquitted because she met the criteria, which in her case was the U.S. code. So in the U.S. code, the language is that she must suffer. It's two prongs. She must suffer from a severe mental disease or defect. And as a result of that severe mental disease or defect, she was unable to appreciate the nature and quality of her action at the time of the alleged crime. So nature and quality is the second prong. So yes, you could have bipolar disorder and be psychotic, but you still know that what you're doing is wrong, and you understand that what you're doing is wrong. She met both of those. And so she did have a trial, but it wasn't a jury trial. It was a trial before the judge with both sides, you know, the prosecution and defense. And the judge acquitted her, meaning he found her not guilty by reason of insanity in the U.S. Code.
Despite being found not guilty by reason of insanity, Kelly is still institutionalized, and if she's ever released, she will have to be continuously evaluated. We asked Dr. Taft how often Kelly is evaluated within the facility she's currently in.
It's every year, and the judge, the prosecutor, and the defense attorney all get a copy of the report every year done by the experts in the facility. They're either psychiatrists or psychologists that are doing the annual evaluation. There's a team of people. One of my places of training was the Not Guilty by Reason of Insanity unit at Eastern Virginia Medical School, and the location was Eastern State Hospital. What we did is there was a team of people that would evaluate these people literally on an ongoing basis. It's not once a year we get together. There's a treatment team discussing this person and preparing evaluations to and reports so that we can keep the courts and the key players aware of their status. So that's why she's acquitted, because ultimately, if she does regain access to the community because she's found to be stable enough and no longer dangerous to the community, then she'll be released back to society and she will not be considered a felon. She will be considered a person who was not guilty, found not guilty. And so if she makes it back to society, she will be under a little more scrutiny, or perhaps a lot more scrutiny, than you and me. You know, we're walking around a free citizen. But she's going to have certain people in her life that are over looking over her shoulder, making sure she's taking her meds. She has to report, things like that. She doesn't just get to go back free of any sort of oversight. It's not necessarily probation or correctional, because remember, she's acquitted. So she's going to be under the mental health authority, and she will be required to follow whatever guidelines of release from the hospital. And then should she start to show signs of decompensation, or she doesn't follow those guidelines and isn't complying with her treatment, I believe she can be pulled back into the hospital system involuntarily, so that, again, society is protected from her harm toward the community, and that she herself is protected from harm to herself.
When looking at Asacia's case, it can be difficult to understand why Kelly did the things that she did. Dr. Taft explained that being in a manic state could have potentially led her to become delusional.
Most people think about mania and they're like, oh, well, they're grandiose, or they're super excitable, or they think everything in their life, all their problems have been solved. But sometimes it's irritable mood. And if they stay this way for at least 1 week with at least three symptoms, okay, three of these symptoms, inflated self-esteem or grandiosity, decreased need for sleep, increased talkativeness. Now, it's not just me, like I'm talking right now and you're listening, but this is the type of increased talkativeness that is alarming to people. You're like, what drug is this person on? Because they're talking so loud and so fast, and you can't get a word in edgewise. Now imagine that state lasting for a week continuously. Their thoughts are racing so fast they can't keep up with them hardly. They're easily distracted. They have a massive increase in goal-directed activity. I had this guy one time, and he came in. He goes, oh my gosh, he had lost like 50 pounds. He had bleached his hair. He had cut it short. He looked physically really good, but it was because he was manic. And he was like, I started this pipe business online. I'm making a golf course on my back acreage. He listed about four or five other things that he did. And I looked right at him and I said, Joe, that wasn't his real name. I said, Joe, you're manic. You're off your medication. He was like, no, I feel great. Everything. He was yelling, literally yelling in my face. And we're like 5 feet apart in my therapy office. And like at one point in the session, he drops to the ground and he does like an alligator roll and flips back and forth, rolling across my floor. And he's giggling and he's going, I have solved everything. And I'm literally going, okay, at this moment, I've got to get this man some help that is beyond what a therapist can give. And so I called a family member. They came and they got Joe and they took him to a hospital, and he stayed in that hospital for a good month and a half. Because he was just at the top of these symptoms. So sometimes a person can stay in touch with reality like Joe, okay? He was somewhat in touch with reality. He wasn't delusional. He wasn't hallucinating. He was just grandiose, and like he felt great. And later on, just to finish the story, he came back. I saw him in therapy for years. And he said, man, I'm going to tell you right now, that was the greatest feeling you could ever have. And I miss it. So he was on his medicines and it took all the joy out of his life. And when he was manic, he would feel like elated, like those moments you and I get in our life where we're on a mountaintop experience. But that was like continuous for him every day. He didn't need to sleep. He didn't need to eat. And so that's what happens. And if a person pushed long enough in that state, perhaps like Kelly, they become delusional. And when a person becomes delusional, that starts to alter reality for them. Let's say she got so manic at times that she slid into a delusional state. A delusion is an unshakable belief in something that isn't real, true, or likely to happen. Okay. And it's possible, based on what we're hearing, that she began to become delusional about this baby needing protection from abusers. That's what it sounds like happened. So in her mind, she was doing something to save this child by abducting it and taking it away from the abusers. Now, remember, that wasn't real. There wasn't any proof that that was really happening. But in her mind, it was as if it really was. So what's the difference between Kelly and a good citizen, a good family member who was really protecting a child? The difference is reality. She believed it was happening and it wasn't. So she takes this baby and runs off to Idaho, and she's in her mind self-righteous, and she's terrified, and she's, you know, thinking that she's this baby's savior. And in her mind, she could even, like Andrea Yates, kill this child in order to save it from the abuse. Like, you know, you can see how sometimes people have these kind of religious thoughts, and they go into this thought, I'm going to protect this child by sending it to heaven. It'll be better off in heaven. And I've even had people who've said, God told me, or Jesus Christ told me, that if I do this, it'll be better. And they believed that literally Jesus or God told them that. And I know in other faiths, it was, you know, Muhammad that told them that, or Buddha told them that. It's not just a Christian thing. We have this thing where people will float off in these delusions, and it's real to them. And they believe, imagine if God came to you right this second, appeared before you in voice form or visual form, and said, you must get in your car right now and go get that baby and take it away from those horrible, evil people trying to harm her. You're my only hope. If God really did that to you or to me, we wouldn't be like, yeah, maybe. We would be compelled to go do that behavior, because we would be so filled with feelings and thoughts that were just things we've never experienced before. God just talked to me. I've got to go do this. And we would go do it. And then when the police grab us and arrest us, we're screaming and crying. We're going, oh my God, no, I was doing God's will. And the police are looking at us like, oh, I know what's up. They're on meth, or they're on angel dust. I don't know how many times I've heard that by police. They had to be on coke, you know. And the truth is that's the problem, is people with bipolar disorder are 30 to 50% likely, based on, you know, the latest studies we have, to have a co-occurring substance abuse problem at some point in their lives. And that's because the two and two go hand in hand. Like, if you're depressed, you want to feel better, so you do things like meth to feel better. If you're manic, you don't need coke. You're already basically on it, you know, but you need something to bring you down, so you might be drinking. And the same with schizophrenic.
We also briefly spoke about Kelly and her diagnosis of schizophrenia.
Undifferentiated schizophrenia is probably the most complicated to treat, because it doesn't really fit cleanly into any category. And the form of schizophrenia that tends to respond best to treatment is paranoid schizophrenia. Well, sometimes she's grandiose, sometimes she's disorganized, sometimes she is paranoid, sometimes she's all three at once, Kelly is. So I would say it's probably on the more severe end of a very severe condition. And we know that Kelly abused drugs. We know that at least there was an allegation, as in the documents I read, that she may have been even selling drugs at times. So she might have been sophisticated enough to appear somewhat normal to people at times, And then at other times she was intensely delusional and, you know, violent. You know, for example, when she just had this thought one time to want to shoot a little girl in the back and the leg with a BB gun. That's not a normal thought. So was that part of her delusions or was that part of her substance abuse ridden mind? We don't know. In my opinion, she had a very severe case. And when you read the documents from the experts, she had to prove at a clear and convincing evidence standard that she was not a threat to the community. That's how dangerous to the community the court system thought she was. And that's how dangerous to the community the experts thought she was. And then you look at the history of failed treatment, you know, not following through with treatment, and then repeated violations of the law and ongoing substance abuse. And we have this horrible mix of extremely severe mental health conditions that she struggled with very poorly.
Kelly did take medication for her illnesses, but there were many times she simply could not afford to do so or did not want to take them. A common issue amongst those who live with mental illness is that they either feel the medication is working and believe they can go off of it, or they do not like the side effects. Dr. Taft elaborated on this.
People with mental illness often, and these, I'm talking kind of more these extreme forms like bipolar disorder where it's real out of control like this, you know, they don't like their meds. Their medications don't make them feel good. They make them feel nothing. They make them tired. They make them have side effect symptoms that they just don't like, and they have to comply with it. So these are not people who generally comply with anything. They're not consistent with anything in their life, and yet they're supposed to take a pill every day at a certain time that doesn't really bring them any joy. And so ultimately, it's so much more rewarding for them in the moment to go down and to walk the street or go to a known drug dealer's house and trade money or sexual favors or whatever they have to do to feel good. And if they have to steal to do it, they'll do it. So they become accidentally criminals because they have this underlying mental illness. Secondary to that, they develop a co-occurring substance abuse addiction. And we say, well, they're a criminal. The criminal thing usually comes second or third to that because it's a result of needing the substance to feel good again, either to calm themselves down or to bring themselves up. And so I could see, you know, you could easily paint this woman to be this horrible, awful, evil person who is a criminal, who plotted, who lied, who deceived, who premeditated. And that could have been the case. Or you could see this woman as a person who has this awful mental illness. We don't look at people with cancer and go, you sick, awful, wretched person, you have cancer. You know, yet we do with mental health because we don't understand it and we judge it by its behaviors, its symptoms, its side effects. And so this woman could be painted either way. The court in this situation, and this is rare, I mean, very rare, overwhelmingly the court, the judge, the prosecutor, and the defense attorney all agreed based on multiple expert reports that this woman was a severely mentally ill human being who was very dangerous to herself and others and needed help versus imprisonment. That's what the court decided.
It's been nearly 17 years since Kelly abducted Asacia. While authorities believe that she drowned back on that fateful day in May of 2003, it's been a struggle for her parents to come to terms with since her body was never located. And Kelly has done some things that make them question just exactly what she did with Asacia. For her mom, Casey, this has all been too much to bear, and she just can't bring herself to speak about what happened anymore. Adam told us what the aftermath has been like for his family and how he's been able to find a path to forgiveness.
Casey wanted to move on from that part of her life and let it go. When you look at the statistics of couples that have lost a child due to kidnapping or anything, 99% of them don't make it and they separate. Like I said, she's moved on, and it's her wish that people just stop talking about it because she just doesn't want to go back there. It's hard for her. I mean, she lost a child and a mother. She has lost more than anyone else. And in order for her to function and to be able to go to the next day, she has to push that away and not dwell in that area. As hard as it is, I've moved beyond it and have forgiven Kelly. I'm a Christian and I believe in forgiveness, and I believe that there's power in forgiveness, and there's also power in holding on to things that eat at you, that if you don't move on and forgive them for that hate and that energy is just going to eat at you, and it's just going to destroy you. I would fight with myself because I would think that if I ever saw her, I'd want to kill her. I mean, and that's just being honest, and I don't feel like it's a bad thing to say that, but I know in the whole grand scheme of things, for me being a father of my children, to which I love, and I love Asacia, and that love for them would dictate for me to move in a position of love, and that I can't sit and hate, because that's not who I am.
So what happened to Asacia Bishop after she was abducted by her grandmother on May 25th, 2003? We know that she took Asacia across state lines into Idaho, where they stayed the night at the Red Lion Inn in Idaho Falls. It was on the following day that Kelly was spotted near the river with Asacia. And then she turned up at the hydroelectric plant, soaking wet, stating that her granddaughter was in the river. Kelly initially told police that this was an attempted murder-suicide, but then changed her story, stating that she was playing with Asacia in the water when she lost her grip on her. Despite extensive searches of the river, Asacia was never found. There are some things about Asacia's disappearance that have left lingering questions about what actually happened. Like the clerk at the Red Lion Inn stating that a man had checked out of the room that Kelly and Asacia had stayed in. If there was a man with them, who could he have been? And why has he never come forward? Also, Kelly has written letters indicating that Asacia is alive. But due to her severe mental illnesses, it's difficult to know what is reality and what may be a delusion. Asacia's parents are left to wonder if Kelly could have given their child to someone. During our research into this story, we asked law enforcement officials from several jurisdictions to grant us an interview, but they declined because their case is still open since Kelly was prosecuted at the federal level. They may choose to charge Kelly at the state level if she's ever released. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Asacia Bishop, please call the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office at 801-743-7000. You can follow Asacia's case on social media at Asacia Bishop Missing Child.
This woman's severe mental illness was so bad that even in those perfect conditions, group therapy, individual therapy, milieu therapy, which means she's surrounded by all this healthy stuff going on, these healthy people, you know, she has the best of medicines available to her, the best of doctors available to her, and yet she still can't be evaluated as being not dangerous to the community. That tells us how sick she is. This is not a faker who manipulated her way into a cushy little hospitalization instead of prison, because she's been there for 17 years. That's how sick she is. She's probably still incapable of admitting to what she did, appreciate what she did was wrong, and take responsibility for it. And because of that, she's referring to the little girl as if she's still in present tense. She probably really believes the little girl is still out there somewhere, or in some form, maybe still walking planet Earth, or maybe she's her angel in her mind, but she doesn't think she did anything wrong. That's really scary. Like, when you get into that type of delusional thinking, those are the people who are very dangerous to society.
I wish a miracle would happen and she would be found one way or the other, alive or remains something, some lead of where she may be. And if she was in the water, I would like some proof, something. But they said there's nothing. again, they didn't put the effort like I felt they should have. They didn't put enough effort either way to look into this situation. Mental health issues. Everyone needs some help, but there's not any help to be found for these poor souls. Look at the housing. No housing. We've got so many homeless out there. We've got so many health issues out there. Maybe if there was something out there, it would help my daughter. And I would have my granddaughter here.
That brings us to the end of episode 223. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for this story. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by contributing on Patreon, where you can get early and ad-free episodes. Join me next time. I'll be covering a case from California. Thanks for listening.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.